Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I was 10 years old or so. I was almost 11 years old when the war ended. The early part of it I didn't really remember very much. I was very young. No television in those days. But a lot of my relatives were in the war. Thankfully, they all came back toward the end of the war, even with the radio. My folks really weren't all that political, but even with radio, my dad followed the news on the radio, the people who were popular at the time, and the nightly news programs, which were a shadow of what they are now. I can't remember just how good or bad they were. All I wanted to do was listen to Captain Midnight and Superman back in those days, Terry and the Pirates, things like that. But toward the end of the war, 43, 44, 45, I realized there was something major going on. It certainly concerned me, although no bombs fell in Boston where I was growing up. I never had any fear that anything like that would. And it was very calm over here. While Europe was in turmoil, Asia was in turmoil, North Africa was in turmoil, terrible war, but I remember it. And I certainly remember what happened in the aftermath of the war, and I've written plenty about it, beginning with Truman's war on North Korea. There was a blatant act of aggression. It had nothing to do with North Korea invading the South. It had everything to do with the South provoking North Korea to give Truman the war he wanted. And on and on and on, Vietnam, Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq, Central American wars, African wars, all kinds of other wars, direct wars, proxy wars, and finally NATO has been around since the 1940s. Rick, I call it what it is, a killing machine. It sure is. And the comments coming from Anders Fogh Rasmussen, I mean, he almost comes right up to the cusp of saying NATO is ready to declare war on Russia. not quite, Rick, but it almost sounds that way.
No, I mean, it is an international war-making machine, one that's been refashioned from its Cold War period role, which was to provide the pretext. It was a Trojan horse, that is, for continued U.S. military presence in Europe. We know that the supreme Allied commander for Western Allied forces, British and the U.S. in the first instance, during World War II, Dwight D. Eisenhower, immediately transitioned to becoming supreme Allied commander Europe for NATO, so there's really been no end to World War II, I think one could effectively argue. NATO is the bridge between the deadliest war in history, through the Cold War into the post-Cold War new American imperial order. So that all of what you say, of course, is true. And statements emanating not only from the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, but most recently from the top military commander, Eisenhower's successor, as Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, Philip Breedlove, are increasingly sounding menacing, indeed threatening, vis-a-vis Russia, as you indicate. And most recent, I just received an email a moment ago that Breedlove, the top military commander of NATO, is saber-rattling at Russia, not only about Crimea, but about the breakaway Transdniester Republic in Moldova. And so what we're seeing is a game of brinkmanship to see how far they can taunt and provoke, if possible, Russia into some action that can be then construed to invoke NATO's Article 5 war clause.
Oh, indeed, Rick. I caught a clip of Breedlove making an inflammatory, absolutely false accusation against Russia today, about 30 seconds or so, a comment that he made. I don't know who he was speaking to, whether it was a congressional committee or what it was. Might have been that. But he made a comment about, Russian troops are massed on the Ukrainian border, like an invasion is imminent, that kind of stuff. And this gets fed over the major media, and it gets repeated over and over again. And they're literally stoking the flames of inciting a war with Russia. It's incredible. But the notion that Russia has troops massed ready to invade Ukraine is absolutely nonsensical. But this is what you hear, and this is what the major media regurgitates. And too many people get fooled, no matter how many times they've been fooled before, to believe this kind of rubbish again. And of course, nothing like that will happen.
No, you're correct. The actual quote from Breedlove, according to Reuters, and while he addressed the German Marshall Fund organization, the U.S. version, I believe, says that the Russian force that is at the Ukrainian border now to the east, well, I'm glad he's instructing us in geography, as though people didn't know Russia was to the east of Ukraine, is very, very sizable and very, very ready. You know, he must be clairvoyant. I mean, he not only clairvoyant delusional, he not only sees a non-existent army on the Ukraine's eastern border, of course, but knows their degree of preparation and readiness as though he's the actual commander. I mean, this is the sort of nonsense and rubbish that passes as news. And this is one of America's two major press agencies, Reuters, Associated Press being the other, and that they could pass on pablum and nonsense like this, and that people swallow, digest it, is really very sad and dangerous.
Indeed it is, Rick.
Scoundrel media, as you call them, Stephen.
Oh, indeed. I love that term. I mean, they really are scoundrel media. And as far as I'm concerned, the New York Times is every bit as bad as Fox News. It's worse than Fox News because it has global reach. You know, they sound a little bit more erudite than the Fox News types. Fox is in your face and that kind of stuff. And, I mean, they come right at you, and I guess their loyal listeners or viewers, whatever, eat up that raw meat that they throw at them. And the New York Times comes off as being something very professional. I must say, Rick, the most popular article in terms of readership that I ever got was an open letter that I wrote to the New York Times over a year ago now. But on one website, it got close to 50,000 readers, and it wasn't the best-known website. I was absolutely astonished that struck a nerve. It told me, Rick, that people are so fed up with the major media, the scoundrel media, and the New York Times being, the lead actor of that scoundrel media brigade, that they just jumped on this article to see what I had to say about it. And I went in their face. I did it politely. I did it professionally. And then I challenged them in my article. Why don't you do A, B, C, D, a whole checklist of things that they could do to really be responsible journalists and serve their readers? And I challenged them to do the right thing and do this. I called doing the right thing is its own reward. And indeed it is. And, of course, I never got a response from the Times. But I'll bet because of the readership that I got, and I would imagine circulation and repostings, I'll bet you they saw that article. But, of course, they never let me know about it.
I mean, you're to be applauded. You performed a service for humanity. The New York Times is indeed the flagship of global imperialism, you know, even more than the London Times, which may have formerly fulfilled that function. And that, unfortunately, it's been able to bamboozle and mesmerize, you know, a good number of otherwise well-meaning and decent human beings for whom the New York Times and everything it prints is gospel truth. By nailing your 95 theses to the door of the New York Times, you've done the world an immense favor. You know, if I may, just to be anecdotal, but I think it illustrates a broader point. A few weeks ago, in some obscure blog page on the New York Times online edition, some low-ranking academic adjunct professor at Podunk University, something or other, wrote a very ill-informed, short, meaningless, really, article plotting global NATO. And I simply, in the reader's column, Stephen, you know, said that I'm the manager of the Stop NATO list, which is the only thing of its sort in the world, really. I mean, you know, daily news against NATO. And that I took objection to this fellow and so forth. You know, they wouldn't even publish my response in the letter section of an obscure blog page. So, and what would it have cost the New York Times to have done that, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Instead, they give feature op-ed space to a member of the Saudi royal family. I believe that was at the end of last year, and I wrote about it. They gave it to this character, Navalny, in Russia. This convicted embezzler who poses as an anti-corruption activist. They gave him feature op-ed space. Gary Gasparov, they gave him feature op-ed space. I wrote about all three of them. I mean, this is the kind of stuff the New York Times features, and he put up somebody good, and they simply ignore them. Once in a while, they throw in someone, you know, to the exception proving the rule, Rick. But generally, you get this array of people that you absolutely should walk away from and ignore, and they feature them in op-eds.
They're nothing other than an outlet for the State Department. And you're talking about guest editorials, so-called. In many instances, it's transparently obvious, you know, they're ghost-written. You know, Mikhail Saakashvili from Georgia, Hashim Thaçi from Kosovo, you know, the latter, you know, veritable illiterate, you know, as regular guest editorials, not even the New York Times, but the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, that's the triad, that's the trio. And that, you know, somebody in the State Department or the Central Intelligence Agency crafts some little article attributed to their stooges, and then, you know, who don't speak English for the most part, and then, you know, that appears without even a, you know, translator identified in the New York Times, and right on cue. whenever there's a crisis or whenever it's necessary to get the State Department's line out, then one of the U.S.'s satraps around the world is paraded on the op-ed page of the New York Times. So it's just a reprehensible and repulsive scandal rag, and that's all it is.
Oh, it really is. I call it the closest thing to an official Ministry of Information and Propaganda. America doesn't have an official agency, but the New York Times comes about as close to acting in that capacity. And this is what they do. And they're militantly on this. A line that I like to use a lot, Rick, I use it for all of the major media, but when America goes to war or plans one, the New York Times and all the other scoundrel media march in lockstep. It doesn't matter whether it's a legal activity, an illegal activity. I don't know of any American war, even World War II, where Roosevelt suckered the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor. He really didn't want to do it. He felt that he had to do it to survive, even though it knew it was a foolhardy move, only hoping at the time that maybe they could withstand more pain than America could. So America might get tired of losing a lot of forces in the Pacific, and they might say, oh, the hell with it. We'll leave it for the Japanese when we're going home. But they were wrong, and of course they didn't count on super weapons being developed. But Roosevelt wanted the war in Asia fairly early in his term, maybe in the early mid-30s. Didn't say a thing about the Nazis, but he wanted the war. He got the war he wanted. So in World War One, Wilson campaigned on a promise to keep America out of the war, and he broke his promise straight away in office, got America into it. My dad was in World War One in France. He came back, thankfully. But, these guys are bald-faced liars. Doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat Woodrow Wilson, Democrat Franklin Roosevelt, Republican George W. Bush, or Democrat Obama. I mean, they're all the same. I'll take Roosevelt. I don't know about Wilson, Federal Reserve Act. Espionage Act, Sedition Act. Pretty awful stuff, Rick.
What you're saying is, I can recollect in terms of an impending U.S.-Japanese war that Jack London warned of just such a thing when he was a correspondent in the Russo-Japanese War in 1905 to 19, in that period. And, H.L. Mencken, the American man of letters, in 1923 laid out in graphic detail what a U.S.-Japanese war in the Pacific would look like. It doesn't take a prophet or a clairvoyant to figure these things out. If natural resources and sea lanes and your geopolitical objectives of various other sorts are at stake, then eventually two powers are going to clash. You know, if we live in a world as we do now where might makes right, or pretends to, and that, military might, in the words of the Frenchman of the 16th century, God is on the side with the large battalions. 17th century, actually. Bussy Rabutin. And that, as long as this kind of barbaric, attitude dominates, then this is what's going to happen. I mean, it's pretty obvious, and they'll set up the pretext for it as they are right now. You know, what a lot of people are talking about what's happening on the ground in Crimea or in Kiev, but I think what is far more alarming is what is happening around the fringes. You know, the NATO border on Russia, if you will, and the fact that the U.S. is deploying 10 F-15s to Lithuania, fairly sophisticated warplanes, rotating 12 F-16s to Poland at the very same time. Up until yesterday, had a warship in the Black Sea drilling with the Bulgarian and Romanian navies right across the waters from Ukraine. Is going to be holding a multinational military exercise in Bulgaria on the Black Sea shortly. Is going to be holding in July a war game in Western Ukraine. The U.S. is going to be leading with NATO allies and NATO partners, so that you have this steady, and then NATO AWACS aircraft flying over Poland and Romania. So you see a steady buildup of something that we've drawn the parallel before, that this year, of course, is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War One. You talked about Woodrow Wilson. There was his major crime. And that, the war to end all wars and the war to make the world safe for democracy and such like. Well, of course, it didn't end all wars. It just spawned even more catastrophic ones. But that, in the summer, the springtime, let's say in March of 1914, nobody could have foreseen. Well, maybe the more astute observers at the time could have foreseen what was going to happen. You know, the bloodiest and deadliest war in history would go on for over 4 years. But we're in a situation right now where the maneuvering and the military buildup from the West, from the U.S. and NATO, are far more evident than anything that happened in the spring of 1914. And I think, you know, correspondingly, we have all the more reason to worry about the repercussions.
We have an awful lot to worry about, Rick. The notion, we've had two global wars. Humanity was lucky. There were no super weapons in those wars. Atom bombs only came about at the end of World War II. When the war was over, Hitler surrendered in May. The bombs were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima in August, a few days apart. The war was over. The Japanese were trying to surrender. They tried to surrender months earlier. Roosevelt turned them down when he was living. Truman turned them down. The generals at the Pentagon wanted to try out their new toy in real time. So, you know, they incinerated a few hundred thousand Japanese on top of firebombing Tokyo and multiple other Japanese cities. Who knows how many other Japanese civilians. Civilians were literally murdered in cold blood. The atom bombs killed far fewer people than these terror bombings. Japanese structures in those days were wooden. You drop incendiary bombs on places like Tokyo. There were two major raids on Tokyo, I believe, and other Japanese cities that were firebombed. I don't know how many people were killed in those. Hundreds of thousands for sure. Innocent civilians. And this is the way America wages war. A war without mercy. Anybody who thinks that the bad guys in World War One or World War Two were the Kaiser and allies back then, and then Hitler and the Japanese and Mussolini in World War Two, they were pretty bad guys. But America matched the worst of their war crimes. And Rick, I've written articles about them. Just horrific things that went on, outrageous things. Even military forces cutting off ears of people they just shot in cold blood, taking them home as souvenirs. Who ever heard of anything like that? Torture was used. All kinds of things we use. The worst of what the Nazis and the Japanese did, the Americans matched them blow for blow, but you never read about that in U.S. history books.
No, I fear you're right. And what we've been, once again, I think, duped into thinking because a war is fought for an allegedly justifiable cause and all the actions contained therein are justifiable. And that's faulty logic and it's rank immorality. It's stating that, if the alleged purpose for which I commit an action is a praiseworthy or noble or at least defensible one, then anything I do in the course of performing that action is also justifiable or noble or worthy, and it's not. You know, war crime is a war crime, whoever perpetrates it. And if it's gratuitously perpetrated by a country that did not even initiate the conflict, so I think what you're talking about with the war in the Pacific between the U.S. and Japan, it certainly was not one the U.S. did not welcome. And, the degree of, how we want to attribute responsibility for the war altogether, and if there is, in fact, an innocent party in there is something subject to dispute. But nevertheless, you know, the fact that we can firebomb cities, and by the way, not only in Japan, Germany, Italy, France, any number of other countries where we caused, with our British allies, caused a good deal of civilian suffering and death. These are war crimes per se. There's no justification for bombing civilian targets.
Oh, absolutely. Firebombings in Germany, and the Britain had its own Obama Harris, was that his name?
You know better the name.
I believe it was Obama Harris, but America firebombed. What was the major city in Germany that was firebombed?
Dresden,
absolutely Dresden. Kurt Vonnegut wrote a book about it. I forget the name of the book, but it's on my shelf. I read it years ago. But yeah, the firebombing of Dresden, maybe Hamburg was firebombed. I mean, this stuff is just killing, gratuitous killing of civilians, you know, inflicting, but these are war crimes, Rick.
And we've seen it fairly recently, haven't we? I mean, this will be the 15th anniversary in a couple of days. Tomorrow will be the 15th anniversary of the beginning of the 78-day air war by the U.S. and NATO against an essentially defenseless Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, where within days, if not within hours of the 78-day onslaught, all the identified military targets had been hit. And, rather than packing up and going home, they just started looking for targets of opportunity and were bombing bridges and oil depots and schools and housing complexes and factories, passenger trains, you know, anything they could hit, with expressed intent of hitting civilian targets, right? Not as an accident, as collateral damage, but as a specifically intended target. If that's not a premeditated war crime, I swear I don't know what is.
Oh, it really is, Rick, and that's exactly what they did in Iraq. The cradle of civilization was destroyed. They didn't just go after military targets. They went after all the civilian ones, including infrastructure, schools, mosques, universities, high schools, whatever, all kinds of targets that had nothing to do with military significance, and they deliberately do this. And, of course, they killed civilians. They didn't kill military people. That's what they did. And they did the same thing in Libya. This is the way America fights its wars, and, of course, NATO is U.S.-led. These are grave, grave war crimes, but, again, this is completely blacked out of the U.S. media reports. People who get their news on TV or read the New York Times or Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, indeed, they do not get the truth. All of this stuff is hushed up, and American wars are humanitarian wars, as they're portrayed, a responsibility to protect. Well, let's listen to this program, and others like it know the real story. They're illegal wars of aggression, war crimes, and the people involved in them, whether it's the president, whether it's the complicit people in Congress, whether it's the scoundrel media who report these things incorrectly, they lie about them, they're all in the same dirty game. They're all guilty of crimes, as far as I'm concerned, and they all, in a just world, they all should be brought up for charges, prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned.
You're correct. I think people forget that at the Nuremberg trials, that Nazi propagandists like Julius Streicher and Josef Goebbels were not only convicted but sentenced to a death to death. I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying this is how propagandists whose efforts have led to the deaths of tens of millions of people were viewed in a perhaps more sensible period. Look, I can recall, flashing back 15 years ago during the war against Yugoslavia, which was prolonged for 78 days, to give the world a real good lesson. You know, as a friend of mine in England said at the time, quoting from Voltaire's Candide, where he talks about shooting a general every so often, or an admiral perhaps in the British Navy, for the encouragement of others. There was a suspicion at that time Yugoslavia was simply a test case, to demonstrate to the world what's going to happen if you don't toe the line. But I remember talking with workmates at the hospital I work with and telling them I was going to a demonstration. They said, "Why? No Americans have been killed." That's a quote. And I then recall 3 years ago when Obama, when the 60 days lapsed under the War Power Resolution, where he was obligated to come to the U.S. Congress and seek their continued, their approval for continued military hostilities against Libya, chose to characterize the onslaught against, military onslaught against Libya, something other than a war, because he, the commander-in-chief, Obama, was not placing American forces in harm's way. So, you can bomb, destroy, and kill people to your heart's content, as long as you don't jeopardize the lives of American service people. It's not war.
It's not war, and all wars are based on lies, every single one of them. And all of America's wars are illegal wars of aggression. There's no other way to describe them, especially in the post-World War II era. Absolutely the case then. There hasn't been a legitimate war fought. The Congress has never authorized the war. And, of course, the Congress authorizing a war means nothing, because the only authorization for a war, one country against another, is the Security Council. It has final and only say. If the Security Council does not authorize a war, it's an illegal war. Security Council didn't authorize a war in Afghanistan or Iraq. That bogus, I think it was Resolution 1973, if I remember it. For some reason, I remember that number. I think it was that.
Libya, wasn't it?
Yeah, against Libya. They gave Washington a wiggle room to claim it could intervene for humanitarian reasons. But, of course, it didn't authorize a war, but Obama used it for that reason. And, of course, Libya was just massacred. Who knows how many people died? It was well, well above the numbers reported. Could have been a couple of hundred thousand people, but that bombing was intense. Civilians were targeted. Infrastructure was targeted. Same ugly stuff, Rick. It goes on and on. And the Ukraine situation worries me. I don't know that something big will erupt because of it, but I'm very scared for the first time in my adult life that something big could happen, whether America and its rogue EU partners want it or not. The way they're acting, the way they're speaking, the way they're playing these dirty war games, putting their troops practically on Russia's borders, putting their missiles, whatever. I mean, they're really itching for a fight, and something may go wrong, and they may get what they want. I certainly hope not, but I just can't imagine the potential catastrophe if Russia and America ever got involved in a belligerent confrontation. And I can say with absolute 100% certainty, that's the last thing Putin wants. It's the last thing he ever, it's the first thing he would go way out of his way to avoid.
No, you're correct. There could be a Sarajevo moment, if you will, as journalists are now beginning to speculate about, you know, the pistol shot that, culminated in World War One beginning, 100 years ago again. And we do have to recollect that the U.S. and Russia remain the world's two major nuclear powers, and that this is arguably the tensest situation between those two major nuclear powers since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962.
Indeed, we've got about 20 seconds left. Any final thoughts?
No, but that, you know, the best of one's ability to shout from the rooftops, if not to influence power, because they've made sure we've been emasculated. We have no ability to influence political events in our country. Scream for peace, scream for non-intervention, because the U.S. is playing with fire. It's playing with dynamite.
Oh, absolutely. Dynamite indeed. But the important work that you do and PRN and all of the voices on the right side of history, we're the only ones that have a chance to avoid this kind of stuff. Rick, many, many thanks. I look forward to getting you back. I'll send you an email when my hour is over.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. John Cozy is my guest for the second half hour. When John is on, we used to usually start with John at the top of the hour, but I cued him to call. He always calls in, and I cued him.
I'm here.
Oh, you're there, John. Hey, you are. 10 seconds ago, my studio said you weren't on, but there you are. Ah, Johnny on the spot. You always call in, and you're always there. Oh, welcome, John. Welcome to the program. John does absolutely marvelous writing. Oh, I didn't get a new article from you, John.
No, I've been having trouble.
Oh, illness?
My eyes and back are giving me a lot of trouble. I've had trouble writing, and I started a piece and went about two pages on it and gave it up. It's not worth the trouble, and have to start another one.
Well, there's always lots to talk about, and I must say I have long overwork that needs to be done on cataracts, but as my doctor tells me, I will let him know when we need to do something. In other words, as long as I can function okay, and for me functioning, I mean, I can be in my car at outside my front door, and a neighbor can be approaching me from the eye of a fairly long hallway. My neighbor can, it's not that long, but a little long, oh, maybe 100 feet or so. And a neighbor can be approaching me from the other end, and I simply don't know who it is until I get up close to get a good look at them. And I don't like wearing glasses, and my glasses really don't help. They don't help with cataracts, that's for sure. And one of these days I'll take care of it. But working online, John, the marvel of being able to enlarge font size makes it very comfortable for me to be able to write and do what I want to do. But when I reach the point when that simply doesn't work well for me, that's when I'll go in and get the cataracts taken out. And I need them in both eyes. But I'm very leery. I don't like surgery. And I'm very leery about somebody messing with my eyes, even though I'm told it's a very simple operation. Well, you know, even the simple things at times go wrong. And if something goes wrong with my eyes, I don't have a spare anywhere, John, to fill in and let me continue with my work.
My advice to you is don't get traditional cataract surgery. Do not do it.
What is the? I don't know what the traditional other is.
Traditional cataract surgery is when they put an artificial lens in your eye.
Oh yeah. And what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative there are two different alternatives you want to consider. The trouble with the traditional surgery is that the lens they stick in your eyes only focuses at one distance, and you can't see anything else. I had that, and it's the worst thing that ever happened to me. And then on top of that, my retina started developing macular degeneration, and I'm slowly going blind, so it's a real problem.
Oh, John, this is an issue that plagued my mother. She had macular degeneration, where you literally, as I understand it, have a black spot in the center of your eye. And, it literally is a slow-going blind process, just terrible. I'm sure glad I brought this up. After the program off-air, John, I very much would appreciate an email from you with the alternative surgeries. So when and I'll save the information, and when the time comes, I will definitely tell my doctor this is what I want.
I think it's called crystal something or other. Crystal something or other, yeah.
Well, I know nothing about any of the surgeries for cataracts.
Well, I'm telling you, you do not want the traditional surgery that they stick an artificial lens in your eye, because the lens they put in your eye won't stretch and change like your natural eye, and consequently they'll give you one for some distance and that'll be it. I mean, they'll either be close or far.
I had not intended to bring this topic up on the program, but I'm glad I raised it accidentally, because you certainly have cued me to something that's very important to me and a lot of people as they age. And
I think the name of that is crystal lens.
Crystal lens.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a little research, and any information you can send me via email, I'd appreciate it. But my intent, and it has been all along, is to do absolutely nothing unless I have to do it. And my goal, frankly, John, is if I can continue functioning the way I am now, I'll never do it. But who knows? The older you get, things wear out. You know, machines wear out, and people wear out. And young listeners, my advice to young listeners is stay young.
People wear out, and I'm almost out.
Well, I'm wearing out, too, more than just my eyes. I mean, this is a function of aging. And finally, you know, I mean, the ultimate bottom line is finally something that keeps you alive wears out. And bingo, that's, that's the end of the game. But let's talk about business. We talked about Ukraine and related issues at the top half of the program. Oh, what's most on your mind, John? I'll just mention one thing. I've been writing daily articles on Ukraine. I began writing last November, and things quieted down a little bit in December. I laid off for a couple of weeks. As anything important broke, I would write an article about it, and things really cranked up a little over a month ago, and I began writing daily articles. A good number of days, I wrote two articles on the same day, and I would say 3 or 4 days, maybe even 4 or 5, I wrote three articles on Ukraine in the same day, because between morning and later in the day, new information came out, important things. Sometimes it was stuff I did not want to wait overnight to discuss the next day. Like I wrote an article a couple of days ago on sanctions wars, when the first sanctions were imposed by Obama, by the EU countries, and I thought that was important, and I knew more was coming, and I had written two articles, and I made that a third one. It was a little bit shorter than a usual article I wrote, but it still ran about 1,000 words, and I discussed that, and I called it Sanctions Wars. I was briefer in discussing succeeding sanctions in two other articles, I believe, and I have an article. I didn't see any breaking news this morning. There was one piece of breaking news, and we talked about it on the first half of the program, John, where this NATO guy, General Breedlove, put out inflammatory comments, bald-faced lies that Russian troops are marshaled on Ukraine border, insinuating that they're getting ready to invade, when the last thing in the world that Putin would ever do is invade any country, let alone Ukraine. He absolutely does not want a war. He wants peace. He's gone all out to support peace. If any two leaders in the world deserve the Nobel Peace Prize legitimately, it's Vladimir Putin and its Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. If I could figure out a way to contact either one of them, I'd love to have them on the program. I would dearly love to do that. Lavrov is really a consummate diplomat. John Kerry is a consummate thug, which is what he is. Hillary Clinton, same thing. Other secretaries of state, same thing. Other key ministries for America, same thing. And Lavrov, I've quoted him so extensively, John. His comments are so measured, so thoughtful, so meaningful, that I wish we had a guy like that representing America and some of the EU countries, but we don't, and this is what Russia is up against. Thankfully, it can defend itself, but the last thing we want is a major war that, heaven forbid, could become World War III.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about it because of that article I promised to, but I'm into it now and thinking about it carefully. But just think about sanctions for a moment. There was an article on the web a couple of days ago about some German company which had sold this big something or other to do with the battlefield maneuvers to Russia, and the German government canceled it. And I thought to myself, well, you know, that's okay. That's the way sanctions work. And what people don't realize is that the sanctions hurt the sanctioner as well as the sanctioned. There is no such thing as a sanction which doesn't hurt the sanctioner. If I'm told I can't do business with Russia, that's somebody I can't do business with. It's somebody I ain't going to sell something to. And the other thing about sanctions that no one seems to consider is they never work. We've had sanctions against North Korea for, you know, decades. I don't know how long. Decades, certainly. Hasn't worked a bit. Had sanctions. We have sanctions against Cuba for more, you know, a long time, maybe five decades. Hasn't worked. We had sanctions against Saddam Hussein. Didn't work. They want to impose sanctions on Russia, thinking that that'll cause Russian to change its policies. But you know, you have to realize that governments, not even the American government, functions for the welfare of its people. It functions for some other purpose. And sanctions imposed on the country hurt the people. Look at Cuba. They don't hurt the Castro boys. The sanctions on Cuba hurt Cubans. And governments don't care about people. I mean, if anybody thinks that the American government cares about people, you know, and just think about it for a moment. We have unemployment insurance dying off, being stopped. Poverty growing, homelessness growing, aid to dependent children being cut. I mean, all of these things, you know, are not beneficial to people. They're injuring the people. And governments don't care whether people are injured. So if a sanction is imposed upon Russia, and Russia doesn't care about the welfare of its people, it's not going to hurt do anything to get the Russians to change their mind. After all, the Russians sacrificed 20 million people in the Second World War. They were sending infantry troops across minefields to keep the tanks from being blown up. I mean, you know, they don't care about people. And the sanctions always injure people, so the governments aren't influenced by sanctions. It's just a stupid kind of thing that people want to apply, somehow or other. We're going to punish somebody. You'll punish somebody, but if you're not going to get any effect out of it, what's the point?
Indeed, John. I certainly wouldn't compare Putin with Joseph Stalin.
I'm convinced from all sorts of different sorts of kinds of evidence that there is no government in the world that is primarily concerned about the welfare of its people. It's concerned primarily about something else.
Well, I agree with that.
And if you're not primarily concerned with the welfare of your people and you're doing something because you're concerned with something else, then punishing your people change what you're doing.
I would say the main thing that the people in power in any country are concerned with is staying in power.
Well, that's part of it, but you know, they have supporters that they're in power for too, and it was Rachel Maddow on CNBC had a show a week or so ago about what happened and why did we go into Iraq, and she said that we went into Iraq to get the oil, and of course Iraq turned out to be a disaster militarily. But she pointed out at the end of the show that oil production in Iraq is up and flowing steadily to Western Europe. So that, America may have paid Americans paid an enormous price for the war in Iraq, but the result of it was a boon to the oil companies, regardless of the fact that we got pants beat off of us. That's really what the Bush guys were after. They weren't after something from Americans. They were after something for the world oil companies.
Well, big oil, as a matter of fact, John, was very much against the war. They wanted normalized relations with Saddam, which they could have had if the Bush administration had gone along with that. But it was eliminating an independent government and putting a stooge government in replacing it. This Maliki government in Iraq is nothing but a stooge government, absolutely brutalizing its own people and very definitely taking care of itself and not giving a damn about ordinary Iraqis. I don't write about Iraq too often, but once in a while I write about the daily violence going on, where in an ordinary month something like 1,000 or more Iraqis are killed by car bombs and stuff like that. I mean, car bombs are blowing up in Baghdad, in other cities. Iraqis are dying by the scores. I mean, dozens of them are being murdered every day, and this goes on, and the Maliki government is totally corrupt, brutal. A U.S. ally, Maliki, was here at the White House with Obama. Oh, I think it's been a few months ago now, but Iraq was utterly destroyed. It certainly has not come back from that horrible war. First, the Gulf War in 1991, I remember so well. I remember where I was the day it began, and then the Bush's March 2003 war that literally ravaged all the civilian targets that had nothing to do with winning the war and killing, my goodness, from 1991 until today, millions, I repeat, of Iraqis, mostly civilians, the vast majority civilians, were murdered by America's wars, allied with the rogue states that participated in that war with them, Britain, France, you know, the usual NATO partners. But America led the war, and millions of Iraqis died in the 1990s alone. Bill Clinton was responsible for at least 1.5 million Iraqi deaths, and two humanitarian coordinators resigned, and I forget the name of the one I wanted to mention, but one of them resigned because he refused to participate any longer with what he called a genocide against the Iraqi people, and he defined it, and I forget whether he'd said a week or every month, but he said he defined it as killing or murdering 5,000 Iraqi children. Children, yeah, both of them were very young, age 6 or 5 or under, killing them every month by neglect. This is a good definition of genocide, and he resigned because of that. But two oil for food humanitarian coordinators, UN coordinators, resigned because of that. The sanctions didn't harm Saddam in any way, but they certainly harmed Iraqi people when nothing was done for them, and they suffered brutally, and these young kids suffered most, and millions of them from 1991 to the present over 20 years, millions of Iraqis were murdered by American imperialism. It really is as simple as that. And Afghanistan, exactly the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's my point. The sanctions punish the wrong people, and that's why they're ineffective as a foreign policy tool. Sanctions publish ordinary people in countries that you're sanctioning, but the governments don't get punished by those sanctions. And the view that the people will rise up and overthrow their governments because the sanctions are hurt has never come true. Never happened. The other thing that I want to point out is, hegemony today doesn't mean what it meant 50 years ago. We talk about America's hegemonic goals or whatever. And, yeah, America has hegemonic goals, but they're not for America or Americans. Therefore, something else. Maybe it's the world financial community. I don't know. I don't have the expertise to know it. We're seeing that the world works the way we want it to, but it ain't for us. It's for somebody else, like the Rothschilds or somebody. I don't know. And that was my point about Iraq. We may, the American oil industry may have wanted us to make peace with Saddam, but the American oil industry didn't suffer because of the war. The American people did, and the Iraqi people did.
Oh, absolutely. And the man's name who I couldn't think of a moment ago was Dennis Halliday. And another program I hosted some years ago, I once had him on as a guest. I think I had him on from Northern Ireland at the time. But he was incensed at the war crimes that were being committed, and he simply did not want them being committed in his name. And he quit, and he gave his reason why. He was very unequivocal about it, and I remember quoting him a few times. It's been a good while. But this is another example of America's dirty wars, John. And absolutely, the tougher the sanctions are, the more they hurt ordinary people, the more they rally in support of the leader of a country, even a so-and-so like Saddam, who else do they have to turn to for support? He was the only guy who could get them food, who could give them any kind of medical care, whatever little they got, and it was pathetically little, but whatever they got from him. And if he didn't exist, they would have gotten nothing. In Syria right now, John, the overwhelming number of Syrian people support Bashar Assad. Overwhelming, maybe 70% or more. I mean, strong support. It may be 80% by now. And the longer that war goes on, the stronger his support gets. When he liberates a town or a village from these death squads that America imports from other countries, the people rally around the forces coming in and thank them. And when he goes out in public and meets with ordinary Syrian people, they rally around him and they thank him for what he's doing. But the U.S. media make him out to look like Hitler, which is exactly what he is not. He's become more democratic in the last few years, but he certainly wasn't for a very long time. Authoritarian was a good way to describe him, but he's been much less so since the war began over 3 years ago. It's in his fourth year now. He much, much less so. There was a legitimate democratic election. 2012, I forget the date, it might have been May 2012, there was a new constitution drawn. It was put to a national referendum, and the Syrian people got to decide what they liked or what they didn't like, and they made changes in the constitution. This is the kind of stuff that went on. America never did anything like that. You know, the people who run America, it's take it or leave it. The power brokers make the policy, and the hell with the interests of the American people. Well, Syria is more democratic than America is today.
Yeah, I don't have any question about that. I mean, the thing is pretty obvious that American foreign policy since the Second World War has been a gigantic failure. There isn't any country in the world more disliked. There never has been a country in the world more disliked than America is today. And somehow or other, the power structure here in America doesn't care. They know it. They just don't care. They don't care about the world's people. They don't care about Ukrainians. They don't care about Syrians. They didn't care about Iraqis, They don't care about Americans. Look, the British Empire functioned successfully from imperial point of view for a long, long time, but the British commoner never gained a thing from it. And the people in Ukraine need to learn this lesson too. Western Europe and America is not getting involved in Ukraine because we care about what happens to the Ukrainian people. There's something else we care about. I think it's the sovereign debt that the Ukrainian government got itself into that America wants to make sure it gets paid to bankers. But
Oh, indeed. No. So, well, the Ukraine will get debt entrapped by the IMF. The IMF makes the neighborhood loan shots look beneficent by comparison. So, I mean, they're going into hawk to the IMF. Severe austerity will be levied against the Ukrainian people, who already are experiencing very, very hard times. It's a deeply impoverished country, and they're going to sock them with all kinds of neoliberal austerity. That's the dirty plan. Plus, these neo-Nazis running the country. America is in bed with the dredges of the world. With these people, I mean, they're anti-Semites, they're ultra-nationalists, neo-Nazis, complete with insignias, iron crosses, and other Nazi insignia. These are the kind of people America is in bed with, and this will be a topic in the book that I told you about, John, the book that Clarity Press will be publishing, I hope, around mid-year. I'd love it to be even sooner, but I'm guessing around mid-year on Flashpoint in Ukraine, and it will be a cutting-edge book, absolutely, with wonderful contributors, vital topics. I'll contribute my own material. It's a very ugly story. And let me mention one thing, John. I don't know whether this information should be in the book or not, but I've got a major article I'll put out tomorrow because of the stuff that's going on, and it'll be top featured on my blog site, Steve Lenman Blog. I urge listeners to take a look at the article. I call it Containing Russia. It's a long-standing policy that goes back centuries worldwide. You know, the British Empire, the German Empire, the French Empire, the Spanish Empire, the jousting with Russia goes way, way back. America really got involved big time around the time of World War I. How many listeners know that Woodrow Wilson, that great Democrat, that great Democrat, sent thousands of Marines as an invasion force into Russia in 1917 to fight the Bolsheviks? How many listeners knew that? It's a fact. Something like 8,000-9,000 Marines were sent in. There were British forces involved. Britain led the campaign. Britain was the imperial power back then. But America's involvement in World War I was really to displace Britain as the major world power. And indeed, that happened at the end of the war. Britain was bankrupt, and America was transcendent. But Woodrow Wilson did that. And really, containing Russia has been U.S. policy ever since. I go through in my article, concentrating mostly post-World War II. It's a very, very ugly story. It's a dirty story, and it's ongoing now. Oh, a final comment from you, John. We've got a couple of minutes.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was just going to say a word about the word provocation. When someone mentions the word provocation, somebody needs to say, to ask it, who was provoked? And if you ask people who say that Putin's actions in Crimea was a provocation, ask them who was provoked. And the answer, of course, is going to be America and Western Europe. But why should Western Europe and America be provoked by an action in Ukraine? The real provocation, of course, took place earlier when Western Europe began trying to influence the actions in Eastern Europe, Eastern European countries, little countries. They're the ones that did the provoking, and they provoked, of course, not only the Ukrainian people who were demonstrated in the streets, but they provoked Putin. And they had a right to be provoked, in contradistinction to Western Europe and America being provoked by anything. So, you know, language is kind of interesting. You have to be careful how you use it, and if you're not using it carefully, somebody ought to have enough brains to ask you to explain it. And if you ask anybody, you know, who is provoked by a certain action, you'll find out who's really got interest in the situation.
Indeed, John, we are just about out of time. I would say this, Putin by no means is perfect. No leader is perfect. But I would say, thank heavens he's around. He's the only leader I know with the backbone and the muscle to say yes to America and hopefully get away with it. He absolutely deplores imperialism. He deplores wars. He goes all out for peace. How many world leaders do stuff like that? There aren't a lot of them around. But Putin absolutely is on that side, and I salute him for doing it. He could improve a lot of other things that he does, but I'm thankful he's around, and if he ever gets word of this program and he's willing to come on as a guest, then I welcome him, and the same thing goes for Sergei Lavrov.
Well,
John, it's been a great 30 minutes. The next time I get you back on, it'll be for the full hour. One quick final comment. I've been down to one program for a number of weeks. I'll be back to three beginning next weekend. Sundays will be live. I'll do two pre-recorded ones. All my programs will be on my archives on PRN. So follow everything I do. Everything will be the same as always, except two archived ones, one live one, three programs. Tune in. Make it a regular habit.
Okie doke.
Thank you, John. We'll be right back.